Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Natasha Pulley.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
You are the author of The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, which sort of took bookstores and readers by storm, and more recently, The Bedlam Stacks.
That's right.
You set both novels in Victorian times. Does that have a particular pull for you?
Absolutely. I love the 19th century, and for me it's partly because of the potential for magic in it. I think for the first time in human history, people are surrounded by machinery that they don't understand at first glance, and I think there's brilliant room for fantasy in there. I mean, of course, a lot of high fantasy is set in this sort of Anglo-Saxon high medieval period, but I think it's really problematic to have a magic plowshare or a magic sword, because I can see how those work and I can see how they were made. It's pretty straightforward. Whereas it's much harder to see immediately how a steam engine works or how a light bulb works or how a pocket watch works. And if someone were to say to me, that might do something unexpected, but don't worry if it does, I wouldn't immediately question it. Whereas if someone said, this plowshare is going to do something really unexpected, I think I'd be more like, really? So I think stories where you want to fit in a little bit of magic into the real world often work better when there is something complicated enough to put it in, which is why the Victorian era is a gift. It's also a gift because all the documentation is there, it's on the internet, it's out of copyright, but the language is more or less the same, so it's very accessible and easy to read. You don't have to go away and learn Old English or Old Norse.
Yeah. And also the workings of Victorian life, and as you say, you know, sort of the machinery of Victorian life had things that you can hide behind. But the workings of Victorian life were also as complex as a pocket watch, you know, and the constraints that people lived within were as complex and as layered and as structured as that. And you really use that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fascinating. And I think, I mean, today, particularly in Britain, I mean, I think we are pretty much still Victorians. You know, we do have a certain problem with sex and with many other things. But I do think there's quite a different culture present, particularly in England in the 19th century. And I mean, one of these things is the idea that you should do things because it will make you happy. That's very modern. And I don't think it was so present then, or, you know, not for the vast number of people. So the strictures of society are far more present because there's not so much this sense of personal well-being. You are working for someone else, often for someone else's benefit. You'll be, you know, kept in shirts and shoes, but it's not, you know, your aim in life is not the American dream. It's not the house with the white picket fence. It's just to survive.
Again, you are one of the cogs in the machine.
Yes, exactly. So many people, I think, were cogs in the machine. And the experience of life as a cog, I think, is one of the things that is really interesting about looking into that period. And to what extent can people push against the machinery? Often not very far, but I think behind closed doors a little bit more than perhaps gets into literature from the period. So it's just a very interesting thing to think about and look into.
Yeah. Okay, so with that in mind, if you could introduce us to both stories, first The Watchmaker of Filigree Street and then The Bedlam Stack.
Absolutely. The Watchmaker of Filigree Street is about a Japanese watchmaker who can remember the future. He's moved to Knightsbridge, where there was, in fact, between 1883 and 1887, a very beautiful Japanese show village on the corner of Hyde Park as part of the Great Exhibition. He's there because he's trying to find his best friend. His best friend doesn't know yet that he's his best friend. It's a turbulent time. There are bombs going off in Whitehall. Huge problems with, I suppose, what we'd call today Irish terrorism. At the time, it was Irish nationalism. All sorts of shenanigans ensue. The Bedlam Stacks is set about 30 years earlier. It's about a young man who has been terribly injured in the service of the East India Company. And as a kind of last hurrah, he's invited on an expedition to collect quinine, which treats malaria, from one of the interior regions of Peru. He's a botanist. They go to Peru. When they get there, they meet a very strange priest with odd habits. And again, all kinds of shenanigans ensue.
Lots of shenanigans.
Lots of shenanigans,
lots of,
yeah.
Lots of shenanigans. One of the things, when you introduce it that way, again, another reverberation in the Bedlam Stacks, is the East India Company.
Yeah.
And talk about cogs and...
Oh, it's just fascinating, the whole thing about the East India Company. I went to the Maritime Museum recently, and there's this whole exhibit there dedicated to the East India Company. It is gloriously curated. What I didn't realise until I went round was that the East India Company had almost sole control of India until it was nationalised absurdly late in 1859, 1860, when it became the India Office. It was an amazing piece of daylight robbery on behalf of the British government. Absolute genius, I think. They took over this huge company, turned it into a branch of the civil service. But that didn't mean the East India Company was gone. It was just under a different name. They kept their headquarters. A lot of the clerks and the board members were the same. They were just in government employ now. But, I mean, it was an incredible company. It was so big that they had their own navy, which was the Bombay Marine. It caused serious problems with everybody's relations in the Far East. They started wars. They started the Opium Wars in China. To think about it now, a super company with its own navy, its own armed forces starting wars, that's a lot like Google starting a war in South Africa. Yeah. It's just
privatization of security.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's
absolutely.
It's not new, as we can see. And
I don't think it
was new, you know, for the East India Company either.
No, I mean, the East India Company was old. It was formed, I think, in the early 1600s, and I think the Dutch East India Company was even slightly before that. So, I mean, we're going way back to Western discovery of Java, places like that, wars about the Spice Isles. So it's just, I mean, it's such a rich subject to look at. And I think very relevant for now, because we are seeing the rise of similar super companies now. And I think I saw an article in the paper the other day where someone said, we need to nationalise Google. And I sort of went, well, maybe not yet, but when they start declaring war on China, yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, and also, we don't know who the hackers who are, you know, declaring war, in essence.
No, exactly.
Where they derive from.
It's
so
terrifying.
Could be. But yeah, and there is a character in the Bedlam Stacks, and there are some objects that recur from your first novel. To me, writing about a similar time, I get the feeling you see things as interconnected, and this is not a sequel, but a sort of a leapfrogging or a filling in of the 360 that you sort of see from that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Watchmaker and Bedlam do share a character. The eponymous Watchmaker appears in two chapters of Bedlam very briefly, once as a small child and then once as an adult. You're absolutely right. It's not a sequel at all. It is linked, absolutely. But as you say, it is part of that filling in of the panorama. And I think it's such a rich period that it would be a real shame to just leave it at one book. It's nice to kind of swivel around and look at other angles of it. And in that same vein as well, I mean, the first book is very much about machinery, technology, development, industry. It's all about watches, light bulbs, mechanisms. This second book, Bedlam Stacks, is about plants and gardens and everything at the opposite spectrum of what Watchmaker is. So it was very nice and fresh to look at something that entirely belongs to the same period, but nonetheless was completely different.
Yes, and there was still that sort of geologist as, you know, rock star explorer.
Oh, yeah.
Going on at the time.
Absolutely.
You know, and as you used Clements Markham, who was a real person who had a, you know, real expedition into Peru. That was happening, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The expedition that I'm talking about in the book really did happen. I mean, gloriously, the two botanists who were actually involved were called Green and Spruce. So that was great. In the end, I replaced them with the fictional narrator, whose name is Merrick, to get the story going. But it was a real expedition. It was led by Clements Markham, who later found fame by, I think, he launched Scots into the Antarctic. He used to be a sailor, and he was very, very involved with all kinds of societies, you know, the Royal Geographical Society, the Navy, everything. And you're right, I mean, this is the age of rock star explorers. And one of the things that I love about these early expeditionary accounts is they go incredibly badly prepared. I mean, they set off basically in a tub where the sea is about 4 inches off the taffrail. And overladen with all kinds of rubbish they don't need. I mean, there are these brilliant accounts of someone setting off to the Arctic with his entire library stuffed into his cabin. And of course, he gets flooded out every 15 minutes. And it's just ridiculous. Like, there is no professionalism about it whatsoever. And I think, actually, if you'd said the word professionalism to a lot of these men, they'd have said, oh, no, that's terribly common and vulgar.
Yeah.
No, a gentleman just gets on with it. It's like such rubbish. They're such morons.
It's like those idiots you see show up at the festival. They're like, what are you thinking?
He's like, what are you doing? Why are you wearing Versace in mud? But these are the guys who are doing these expeditions. And it's just gloriously stupid. And sometimes they do well, and sometimes they go missing and die. Really 50-50. And there doesn't seem to be very much effort involved in the planning of these expeditions to say, well, maybe we should try and swing it more to being successful rather than dying. They just go for it. It's so funny.
So what is the role, other than being magical, of course, of magic for you in your fiction, in your reading and in your writing?
It's so much about escapism. I think often writing students at writing school, I did, are told that you should write what you know, and I feel like it's so much better to write what you don't know. I mean, I have to live being a white middle-class woman of nearly 30. I don't want to write about that. I know what that's like. That's massively dull. I'd much rather write about something magical, there is something about the idea of opening a door and what's beyond it is not what you expect and not what you can explain that I just love. And I mean, I could talk about growing up on a diet of C.S. Lewis and Terry Pratchett and all this, but I feel like it's really visceral and atavistic, that sense that just behind the corner or the riverbend there is something genuinely weird. And it's chasing that genuinely weird thing that I think is what I'm doing in writing. And it's just, I've certainly had people say, well, you know, do you include fantasy elements in order to make a sort of mass political statement? No, it's just joy. I'm just after the joy.
And I was wondering, because you obviously there's, we can hear just from what you've been saying now, you know, a lot of research, like happy delving into you know, archives and things that happens for your books, as well as, I don't know if people have known, you lived in Japan and you went to Peru.
Yeah.
And you learned Spanish and you spoke to Quechua speakers, etc. Does as much, not research, but it has to work, it has to have its own logic, the magic. And
yeah.
Do you spend as much sort of research time, if you will, on crafting
yeah.
your magic?
So part of the reason that these are set historically is that I would be rubbish at flat-out world-building. I find it very difficult to write high fantasy where you just create Middle-earth out of nothing. I mean, perhaps it's based on Anglo-Saxon culture or what have you, but really everything is new, and to do that well is so difficult. Whereas if you embed fantasy in real events, often the real events are kind of so weird anyway that they have the ring of fantasy to them, and it's quite nice to blur the line. And I think what's interesting about both Watchmaker and Bedlam is they are 90% historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The fantasy part is really only the 10%. And it's just, it's much easier to research real stuff and then edge in a little bit of magic as a kind of pepper on the top, rather than just doing the whole shebang ground up, imagined. Exactly. I just can't do it. It's too difficult.
Yeah, you have to be both architect and creator and, yeah.
It's just exhausting. Mm. And the people who do it well are just titans, and I'm not there. There's not a huge amount of research involved in the fantasy because all the research is done on the historical side, and the fantasy just kind of filters through the gaps where the records end.
Mm-hmm.
And I try and do it as naturally as I can. I mean, Bedlam was a very nice thing to write because the fantasy is based on Peruvian fairy tales, so the fantasy was kind of already there anyway.
Mm-hmm. You had a guide.
I did.
I was going to ask you as well about, in particular, in both stories, male friendships are very central.
Absolutely.
Central to the motivations and central to plot and whatever. Why the exploration of male friendships?
Again, it's escapism.
Mm-hmm.
I have this horror of writing women. I don't do it very well. And I think it's because I really don't want to write about myself. That is, there's something horribly narcissistic about doing that. So I find it very difficult to write female characters of my age. And it's just, I want to get away from that. I want to get away from what I experience and what I know and dive into stuff that maybe I don't know so well. So I think it feels more natural to go and look at men and what men did. But the other kind of practical side of things is that one of the things I really don't like about some historical fiction, particularly in TV, I think TV does this much more than novels do, they often shoehorn in a very unlikely, very active woman. And
the
only female doctor of the age, or, you know, the only woman explorer of the age. Mm. Naturally, these people did exist, but they were so far away from the norm that the idea that you would come across one and they would be naturally accepted into a circle of people who were just kind of ordinary in that period, to me, feels so far-fetched. And it's not that I don't want to write about women at all. Of course, they're there, and they represent, of course, 50% of the population, and the men are talking to them, they're involved, they're in every step of the way. But if you're looking at something that's kind of about the world of work, or indeed about striking off over the Andes in Peru, they're not going to be taking their wives with them. And they're, with things like Watchmaker, there were not women clerks at the Home Office. There just weren't. And I think to try and put someone in, even with the very best of intentions, and say, you know, well, we want to talk about women, you know, we want to say, you know, they were there, they weren't.
Well, it's sort of like your plow analogy.
Yeah.
Unlikely to the point I'm not believing the magic.
Yeah, exactly. It's so unlikely. And I think there's something worrying about the idea that we might ever forget that they weren't there. That the extent of
rewriting
whitewashing. And it's just, I mean, the patriarchy was alive and well, I mean, absolutely thriving. And Victorian women particularly were not as involved as we want them to be. They just weren't there. And however much I want to say, let's write about equal rights and, you know, men treating women well, I think it would have been very much in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the men who did treat women well, as we understand well today. It's just that whole morality has changed in the last 150 years. So it's just very difficult to deal with it in a good way.
Mm. Mm. One of the things I really loved, and I've realized is quite unusual, is that there are actual mysteries. I mean, there's always untold stories in books. Nobody sews everything up in a nice little bow. Although that has become more of a norm.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to have a twist and then sew it up. Or things are left very open at the end. You know, at the end you're like, you know, what's next after we leave these people?
Mm.
But you sort of have sort of mysterious untold stories smack dab in the middle.
Yeah.
In plain sight where nobody's looking and just, they don't seem curious, but I'm like, I want to know.
It's, I think partly it's so my experience in real life that you can never find out, like, you know, 70% of the stuff that you want to find out. Someone will just drop a bomb into a conversation, like when I was staying with Kenyan tribesmen in Nigeria. What? But they're not talking about that. They're talking about apples or whatever. And you just cut their isn't an opportunity in normal conversation to say, back up a minute, you need to come back to that and tell me about it properly. You just can't. And I think, especially when you travel, people tell you all kinds of random stuff that you just can't follow up. Or it wouldn't be polite to ask someone too much about their history. I mean, one of my favourite characters in the Bedlam Stacks is a man who works for the India office called Singh. And he used to have a whole chapter to himself, and it got reduced to one line because they just thought, yeah, it's just, you don't need to know. He can just be odd. That's fine with me. Mm-hmm. That happens. Yeah, so I'm quite happy to leave it.
A random person sucked up by the massive vacuum of the East India.
Yeah, exactly.
Deposited on the pages.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I mean, it's obviously in the title. And I'm thinking also of the character Caroline, who is the mother of the main character, Merrick Tremaine, and the name Bedlam.
Sure.
And, you know, there is a theme of potential madness, which is also a sort of nice reflection on how we choose to see the story, potentially.
Yeah, definitely. So Merrick's mother, Caroline, in the book is in a lunatic asylum, a very nice one, a very genteel
country
one.
Club
it's rather
version.
A country club badminton playing, coffee making lunatic asylum.
Exactly.
They have silver pheasants wandering the ground.
Yeah.
She's not getting electroshock therapy in true Victorian style. But she's there because she thinks she's seen a statue move, and she thinks it's killed her dog in their garden at home. And Merrick goes to see her before embarking on the expedition, because he thinks he's seen the same statue move, and he's worried there's some kind of madness that's going to run in the family, and his brother has already accused him of it. So he's worried before the expedition even starts that he's not as okay as he should be. Turns out he's not insane, and nor is she. But it's there. The Bedlam Stacks. Bedlam is the village. It's called Bedlam. It's actually New Bethlehem. It's a kind of mission colony that's run by a Catholic priest. But he's very grumpy and disillusioned, and like the hospital, Bethlehem Hospital, he starts calling it Bedlam. Mm. It's full of people with physical and mental problems. It's a kind of hospital colony. So there's that element to it as well. But one of the things that I'm really interested in is how do different cultures see reality? And it's not like some people are just wrong and other people are 100% correct. It's there are ways and ways, and what's real is often made by the agreement of the culture around you. And it becomes this translation issue towards the end of the book. There's a Peruvian fairy tale, or many, many, many Peruvian fairy tales about these rocks in the landscape that everyone says are people who've turned to stone. And people today will even, you know, tell you this. Of course, if you go in now, you go, no, it's clearly a suggestively shaped rock. Clearly it is. But that it's not so cut and dry as that, because, you know, people towards the tail end of the Inca Empire, and as I say, even now, certainly in the 19th century, believe wholeheartedly that this thing was real and it was a person. And that affects how they conducted themselves day to day. 19th century Peruvian reality was not 19th century Victorian reality. It's certainly not 21st century reality. And I think it becomes a translation issue, because then you have to say, well, how much do you respect that when you speak someone else's language? And often the language is full of references to beliefs that people have. I mean, Spanish is chock full of, you know, may God allow us to do this. By God, I hope, even more than English is. A lot of it's Arabic. And you just have to say, I don't believe that, but I'm going to have to say these things because that's how you say what I mean in this language. But then how do you say to a Peruvian Quechua person, how do you say what you mean in English? And how do you phrase it according to our reality? You have to be suddenly very objective and scientific about it and not spiritual, because if you talk about it in a spiritual way, you sound like a loon. So it is so bound up with language and clashing cultures and everything that they have. That's why it's in the title. It's really important.
And for you, being a visitor to Japan and more recently Peru, you obviously have a very conscious stance and yet go forth anyway. So what is it? I mean, and obviously we all hold lots of dualities within us, but how do you approach that?
Well, one of the really nice things about having to communicate in your second or third language is that you can't just blurt out the first thing that comes into your head, which is usually in your first language and also usually stupid. So second thoughts are really good, because that's when you'll be able to use second language. And so I kind of like potter around the world being, you know, gently atheist and thinking, you know, you should respect everyone, blah, 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 blah. There are probably stupid things that I've done to people and not even realise. But as I was saying before, to some degree, the language will shape your response. In Spanish, you just have to sound more religious than you are a lot of the time. And that is fine by me, because that is just how you say what you're thinking. And the English way is just a way to say it. In Japanese, it's that is a particular way of thinking that you really have to get your head around, because there is no direct way to translate what you mean. You have to come back and say, right, what is the core of what I'm trying to say? Like, forget the phrasing, forget grammar. Like, what am I trying to say? And then put that into Japanese. Don't try and put English into Japanese. And that affects so much more than language as well. We had this nice moment at language school. There were only two kind of proper foreigners in the room, by which I mean not Asian. Everyone else was Chinese. And it was me and a girl from Saudi Arabia. Her family was from near Mecca. She had 54 brothers and sisters, and her father was a sheikh. She's very, very wealthy. And the Shah sent her a big box of dates at Eid. And it was great, and she shared them. It was wonderful. But she came in one day to Japanese class, and she was massively excited because she'd found pictures online. I think one of her brothers had sent it to her, of what they certainly believed to be photographic evidence of giants in the desert. And they were clearly these, I mean, enormous skeletons, but they were also clearly photoshopped. And if we'd been speaking English, I'd have went, mate, they're clearly photoshopped. What are you doing? Again, a stupid thing to say, because she was wholeheartedly Muslim, and I'm just not, and I often don't understand why people are. But that was a first thought. It was an idiotic thought. But because I had to say it in Japanese, I sort of came back and went, no, that's a moronic thing to say. And in the end, what I said was, that's marvellous. Tell me where giants come from. And it was she told me this just the brilliant story about Noah and one of his sons' progenies being giants, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I came away from it going, I really wish that I could believe that there had been giants in the world. That would be a wonderful thing to think. And I came away as well feeling hugely grateful that a conversation had happened in Japanese, because it meant I hadn't pissed all over her very genuine beliefs.
You would have just shut her down.
Exactly. I'd have shut her down in English without a second thought to the fact that that is a culture of English as a language. It would be automatically rude to downright contradict someone in Japanese, so you naturally come away from that anyway. And then to say, actually, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's good that I didn't just smash on in there. And it was, and I got a really good story out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, I don't know if this is correct or not, but I understand your working on your next one, Pepper Harrow?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's just come off my editor's desk onto my desk.
Uh-huh. for some bashing around.
Yeah, for some bashing around.
What can you tell us about Pepper Harrow?
Yeah, it's a return to the world of Watchmaker. It's about the same people. Nathaniel Stapleton and Kate Amori go off to Japan. Nathaniel's been posted to the British legation in Tokyo. They take Nathaniel's ward, Six, with them. And then Mori disappears. And nobody knows what's happened to him or what's going on. And it's about finding out what's happened to him. And it's... I'm having a few difficulties with it, actually, because I finished Watchmaker in sort of 2014. It's now 3 years later. To go back to those same characters and the same voices is quite difficult. And I think it was only recently that I looked at it and went, no, they shouldn't sound the same because they're older. So they will
and
be a little bit different.
They have changed by their lived experience in that time.
Exactly.
And they were living a very different life that I can't imagine didn't change them. From
no,
where we left them.
No, exactly. So they've lived very differently. Daniel's lived much better, certainly. And Daniel ages as I age, so we're about he's about a year older than I am. Or that I'm trying to keep it that way.
So for now,
I'm going to overtake him in about 5 minutes. But and I just think that the amount that I have learned and lived since I was 24, 25 has been enormous. And I was looking at it going, you can't write him the same as he was in Watchmaker. It's just not going to happen. And even Mori as well, because he changes, even though he can remember many things in the future all the time. So it was this odd process of coming back to familiar voices, but going to a real effort to not just mimic what I'd written in Watchmaker, because otherwise I'd just be doing an impression of someone rather than actually... speaking. So that's a really weird thing to come back to, like writing a sequel, but it's all right, it's going all right.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Natasha. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you as well. It's been great.